Thanks for joining us. I'm Jonathan Smith, and you're listening to the Maine Public Broadcasting Network. Today on the program, the state of our oceans. 5 years ago, philanthropist and avid sailor David Rockefeller Jr., along with veteran solo ocean sailor Mark Schrader, came up with a plan, an ambitious adventure, really, to raise awareness about the health of the world's oceans. Called Around the Americas, it would be the first continuous west-to-east circumnavigation by sail of the American continents. Journalists, educators, and scientists joined the journey aboard the steel cutter Ocean Watch. And for part of the trip, so did our guest today, David Rockefeller Jr. He wrote the foreword to the book One Island, One Ocean, which documents the travels of Ocean Watch and her crew. And David joins me from our studios in Bangor. We invite you to join the conversation. Are you a sailor, a fisherman, someone who enjoys the beaches and coastline of Maine? Have you noticed a change to the waterways you frequent? If so, let us know. Email us at talk@mpbn.net, post a comment on our Facebook page, or give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. And David, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Jonathan. I'm glad to be here.
So let's start off. What brings you to Maine today?
Well, I've been spending 10 days of family vacation on Mount Desert Island, something we've done as a family for nearly 25 years, and it's fantastic.
Great. And how long have you been up here for?
About 10 days this time.
Wonderful. All right, now let's get right to the book. Tell us the inspiration behind One Island, One Ocean.
Well, it goes back about a decade for me personally in one way, and it goes back about 60 years in another. I really began as a sailor and boater on the coast of Maine in my childhood. It wasn't, however, until 2000, the year 2000, when I was asked to become a member of the Pew Oceans Commission that studied the health of these oceans, that I realized that there was trouble under the keel, you might say.
Huh. And what did you see? What did the commission report reveal to you, or just in your journeys out at sea? To give us some of the signs about the declining health of our oceans.
Well, the Pew Commission met all over the country, including they paid a visit to Maine. I believe they were in Portland, and they were in Alaska and Hawaii. So the commission itself both saw the issues with their own eyes and heard testimony about these issues. You know, some problems with the ocean are very palpable. If there's an oil spill and you get a slick on the beach, if there's a whole lot of garbage that washes up into your harbor, your beach, you know, these are things that you see. They're not necessarily the very worst problems, however, in the ocean. And there's some of them you have to detect by taking measurements of water quality and pH factor, for example.
And that's what they did aboard the ship, the Ocean Watch, and it's over a year-long journey around the Americas. It started out in Seattle, and you were there for the initial leg of the trip. Tell us about the decision to take this route. I was surprised to learn this had never really been done before.
Well, it wasn't my idea. I'll start with that. Captain Mark Schrader had already been around the world solo sailing twice, once racing, once as a fundraiser for a school he ran in Seattle. And he had never been around Cape Horn from east to west, which is, of course, the traditional way that the European explorers and whalers had to go from Europe around Cape Horn east to west. Mark had never done that, and he wanted to, so he said, guys, we are going clockwise. That's against many currents, many wind currents, and many sea currents. But that's how it got started, from Seattle heading north.
And we'll get to, because you were aboard when the Ocean Watch went past Cape Horn, and we'll talk about that in a little bit. But I want to get to sort of the beginning part of the journey up through the Northern Passage. And that had only been done the first time, what, early 1900s?
Exactly. Roald Amundsen was the first to make it, and it took him 3 years. He went from east to west through the Northwest Passage. As we all know, that passage has been clogged with ice, over human history, and it's only in the last 100 years that boats have begun to get through, most of them icebreakers.
And in some way, though, it made possible because of climate change.
Well, that is the most important reason. It isn't technology that got us through. It's the fact that there has been at least a 5-degree warming in the Arctic region of the globe, closer to 1 degree where we are. And 5 degrees is a whole lot, as you know.
Absolutely. We're speaking with David Rockefeller Jr. He's a philanthropist and avid sailor. In 2003, he served on the Pew Oceans Commission. His commitment to the commission's recommendations are behind his formation of Sailors for the Sea, a new voice for ocean conservation. He's a director and former chairman of Rockefeller Financial. We're discussing the book, One Island, One Ocean, written by Herb McCormick, with photographs by David Thorensen. The book is a journey around the Americas by the 44-ton, 64-foot cutter Ocean Watch. David wrote the foreword to the book and joined the crew for part of the expedition. Tell us a little bit about the ship Ocean Watch. I'm guessing pretty tight quarters there.
Well, yeah, especially when I was aboard for 2 weeks. We had 8 men, and we weren't small. So 2 weeks, you know, we often repaired to our tiny little quarters to do our reading. But so it's a 64-foot steel cutter. That's a sloop rig. She was actually designed to make scientific experiments. We found her in Mexico, and Mark and his team sailed her up north to Seattle and fitted her out there. She was really made into a thorough research vessel. We connected with the University of Washington, as well as Pacific Science Center in Seattle, and they provided the science knowledge as well as the educators. So we were really a science expedition as well as an expedition telling a story.
Join our conversation. Give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. Or send us an email, talk@mpbn.net. That's talk@mpbn.net. Or you can leave a comment or a question on our Facebook page. And going back to sort of the beginning of the journey, can you tell us about the little Alaskan community of Shishmaref? Am I saying that correctly?
Yes. I have not been there myself, but the stories are amazing. And they've been well publicized, actually, in the press over the last few years, because Shishmaref, which is a coastal community on the western side of Alaska, just south of the I think it must be about at the Arctic Circle. And they have the problem of having lost regular winter sea ice. Now, you might think, well, why is that a problem? Certainly for a fisherman, you'd think it'd be better to have open water. Well, for them, the problem is that the winds blow often from the northwest, and which they face. And if the open sea gets at their village, their houses are right down close to the shore, and the ocean has begun to eat the town.
Huh, interesting.
So this is, yeah.
And at one point, the Ocean Watch even inadvertently went aground while approaching the town or the community. So
exactly, very shallow.
Yeah, to real signs of climate, the effect of climate change. Also, sort of on this northern part of the trip, there's an ornithologist that the crew spoke to, George Dvorky. Am I getting that one right?
George Dvorky, whom I happen to have met before. And
tell
he
us about
summers
him.
On a very remote island, which is close to Barrow, Alaska. If you look on the map, that's the northernmost town. We actually visited, by the way, in Ocean Watch, the northernmost and southernmost towns in the world as part of our trip. Now, George Dvorky, the ornithologist, studies black guillemot, and especially the black guillemot chicks. And they migrate up there to lay their eggs on what used to be a very safe island called Cooper Island.
And he was asked if he believes in climate change. Do you recall his response to that?
Yeah, and he says, no, but I believe in polar bears. The reason is, you know, the polar bears used to be very happy catching the seals. And in order to catch them, the polar bears also need ice. They really ride on the ice or walk on the ice and get the seals when they come up for air, which they need to do every few minutes. And when the ice melts, the polar bear loses its hunting ground and loses its prey. And guess what? Black guillemots don't look quite as tasty as George Devoki.
And polar bears, they're just photographs of polar bears, just some of the absolutely gorgeous pictures throughout this book, One Island, One Ocean, written by Herb McCormick with photos by David Thorenson. I want to hear about the Northwest Passage. I mean, at some points, are the crew out there actually pushing away icebergs as they're approaching the boat? Can you give us a sense just how dangerous a passage that is?
Well, if you go the normal 6 knots to 8 knots that a sailboat might go under power, and by the way, we were mostly under power there because we needed to control the speed of the boat, which you can do less well if you have sails up. So they're powering, and they're going more like 2 or 3 knots in dense ice, because if you come up against a piece of ice that's anywhere near as big as you are as a boat, as you know, 90% of it is under the water, mm-hmm. You just put a hole in your boat. So they had to go very, very carefully. They sent Thorsen, the photographer, up the mast to be a lookout just like in the old days.
A true team effort to survive. How long did it take them to get through there?
They left Seattle in May, and they didn't get through till September. So it took them the whole summer. Part of it was going up the west coast of Alaska, but it took them several months to get through.
Wow. We're speaking with David Rockefeller, Jr. He wrote the foreword to the book One Island, One Ocean, Around the Americas Aboard Ocean Watch. We invite you to join the conversation. Give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. David, what did the crew notice about the people and the land it encountered as it went through the Northwest Passage? Are there any sort of generalizations you could make or scientific discoveries even as they traverse this once forbidden area of the world?
Well, one of the things that I remember and I think is issued photographically in the book is underground ice storage, which is beginning to thaw away. You know, they don't need refrigerators up there, as you might imagine. Well, they probably do in the summer, but definitely not in the winter. But one of the pieces of evidence of global warming in the Arctic is that these ice caves are now too shallow. They probably would need to go down another 5 feet or so to keep the same temperature needed to store the fish, for example, and other food that they're preserving down there. So our team went down and looked at these amazing ice caves that are, of course, all constructed by the local villagers. These are hardy people. They choose to be there. I mean, I've been to Prudhoe Bay, which is also on the northern coast of Alaska, and that is some really tough winterscape. But the people, the indigenous people, grew up there. That's home to them, and things are changing in a big way.
And is there? Do they have any recourse? Is there anything they can do about the problems facing them and their community?
Well, I guess maybe you'd say, as in the Shishmaref community, build their houses farther from the ocean. That's expensive. These are not wealthy people by any means. There are many of them, most of them even subsistence hunters of both land beasts and sea creatures. And, of course, eventually some of them move away if conditions change too much. Planes do come in and they do deliver food. Everything is very expensive in Alaska because the roads are so sparse in the outback.
And that's David Rockefeller, Jr. He wrote the foreword to the book One Island, One Ocean, Around the Americas Aboard Ocean Watch. It's a story about the rising issue of global warming, climate change, and its effect around all throughout the Americas. We're going to take a quick break now. When we come back, we'll take your phone calls. We invite you to join the conversation. Give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. Send us an email at talk@mpbn.net or post a comment to our Facebook page. Stay with us.
A Prairie Home Companion is celebrating New Year's Eve live from the South Pacific, from Honolulu. A three-hour live broadcast with comedy and the late-night news from Lake Wobegon, and our special guests, the great slack key guitarist Led Kahupana. Danny Carvalho will be with us, and the king of the ukulele, Jake Shimabukuro. Join us for A Prairie Home Companion, December 31st, Saturday night. See you then.
And that gets underway Saturday night at 10 and will go till 1 a.m. As you know, many businesses in and around Maine join listeners in supporting various public radio programs on the MPBN radio service. To learn how your business can benefit from supporting public radio programming, visit our website, mpbn.net. Click on Business Support to find information about the value of sponsorship, answers to frequently asked questions, and contact information, or call us at 1-800-884-1717 and ask for Susan Tran. And thank you for your support of public radio in Maine.
Welcome back. This is MPBN. I'm Jonathan Smith. Today on the program, a journey around the Americas to bring attention to the state of our oceans. With us from our Bangor studios is David Rockefeller Jr. Join the conversation. Call us at 1-800-399-3566. Send us an email, talk@mpbn.net, or post a comment or question on our Facebook page. And right now we're going to go to Raymond, who's calling us from Portland. Raymond, are you there?
I am.
Hi, do you have a question or comment?
I have a question for Mr. Rockefeller. What is his take on the amount of methane that is currently rising from the seafloor off the coast of eastern Siberia? Apparently, recent news from the Daily Mail, the Russian research vessel, academician Lavrentyev, did a survey of 10,000 square miles of the sea and discovered huge plumes, fountains, if you will, rising from the seabed. Mm-hmm. What's his take on the input of the methane fields and the scale that's not been seen before and how that will affect our oceans?
Raymond, thank you for your call. David, are you familiar with that?
Well, I'm not familiar with the specific plumes. I've been out of news contact for a week or so, Raymond, but I am aware of the problem of methane release. For example, as the permafrost thaws in the far north, including Siberia and Alaska, it too releases methane, methane that's been stored there. Why suddenly there are big plumes of methane release underneath the sea, however, I'm just not familiar with that, whether it relates to tectonic plate movement or storms in the shallows. I just don't know, but I'm going to find out about that.
All right, let's take another call now. Let's go to Peter. Peter, are you there?
Yes, sir.
Hi, Peter. Did you have a question or comment for David?
Yes. Now that Mr. Rockefeller has seen what most of us will never see, which is the effect of climate change and sea level rise, acidification, even environmental refugees, what does he recommend we do about it?
Peter, thank you for your call.
Peter, that's a great question, and of course it's the question because it's one thing to report a problem, and it's quite another to do something about it. There's some simple things that can be done. Refuse single-use plastic, for example, and reduce the amount of plastic you use and the amount of plastic you don't recycle. Those are things that I would say are more than cosmetic. They are important. Plastics, as you well know, get entangled with sea creatures. They get swallowed in pellet form by fish and injure the very food sources that we depend upon. Certainly, at the high end, CO2 is a major, major enemy of ocean health. As it after it goes up in the air from the industrial and automotive and other sources, it gets deposited in large quantities in the oceans that cover more than 70% of the globe, and that, of course, changes the pH or the acidity of the ocean and increases it, leads to destruction of shellfish, of corals, and damages the growth of all sea life. So that's the big one. We need to drive less, be more efficient with our industrial wastes. That really is a very, very big issue. Pollution as well from ships and coastal regions. You know, cities can make sure that their storm drains don't have waste, either human waste or oils getting pumped down them, and that human waste is treated before it reaches the ocean. Gravity takes everything that happens on land eventually into the ocean. So we've got a lot of different ways. Even farmers up the Mississippi are contributing to the nitrogen loading in the Gulf of Mexico, creating a yearly 200-mile-long dead zone that's become quite famous. Obviously, those farmers don't do that on purpose, but we need to find ways to help them keep the excess fertilizers from running into the river and on down into the ocean. So those are a few things.
That's David Rockefeller Jr. He is a philanthropist and avid sailor. He served on the Pew Oceans Commission, and his commitment to that commission's recommendations are behind his formation of Sailors for the Sea, which we'll talk about in just a little bit. He is a director and former chairman of Rockefeller Financial, and we're discussing the new book, the coffee table-sized book, One Island, One Ocean. It has some absolutely gorgeous photographs of this expedition around the Americas. And let's go now to another caller. We have John. John, are you there? Hello, John.
Yes, hello.
Hi, do you have a comment or question for David?
Yeah, one of each. My comment is that I cannot understand how the large portion of the public cannot believe and understand the magnitude and effects of global warming with all the incredible scientific research and whatnot that's been done behind it. And that being the case, what can be done about it to just get these people to hear and see what's really going on?
John, thank you. David, what can be done about that? I mean, you must run into people who either don't believe or refuse to believe. I mean, do you believe that the science is settled on this?
Well, there's science looking at everything from the way that fish adapt to warmer waters to how corals adapt or don't, et cetera. So there's a lot more to be studied. What is very clear is that we are headed for sea level rise in our century, the 21st century, of somewhere at the low end of a foot and the high end of 20 feet. So I hope that we don't have to wake people up by having them discover that high tide is just to float into their living room for the first time. But there will be a great many people around the globe displaced well before it gets to 20, even in the 1 to 3 foot range. I actually think that shows like this do help people understand that climate change is real and that violent climate is much more common, the storms, the winds, et cetera. And I think my attitude toward this is that we need to combine science with effective stories, and that we need to combine statistics with art. And in fact, our book, One Island, One Ocean, does attempt to do that. It's a beautiful book. We hope people who don't even care about the issue will first look at it and get intrigued, read it, and, you know, it's written by a boating writer, Herb McCormick. It's not written by a scientist or an environmentalist. So I think the voices of people, in addition to the scientists, of artists and community leaders, we need to have them speak out as well.
Join our conversation. Give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. A little earlier, David, we received a call from Margaret in Newcastle who wanted to know if you could talk about the status of the Gulf of Maine. How are things looking there?
Well, I think it's a mixed picture, and I don't happen to be an expert on the Gulf of Maine. There's some things that we know, that the lobster population is overall doing well, and most people credit that to the very good self-management of the lobster industry, whereas bottom fishing is not doing as well. I think one of the issues there is that some forms of bottom trawling actually interfere with the integrity of the bottom habitat, the place where fish grow and live and feed. And so certain types of bottom trawling do damage to the very place that you are fishing in, and we need to address that. The cod are coming back slowly, as I understand it, and I think indicating that some of the rules in relationship to cod fishing seem to be taking good effect. There's a kind of a fallowing, as you do in agriculture, where you let a field rest for a while before you plant in it again. And I think it seems that has been promising in the Gulf of Maine. I hope I'm right.
All right, let's go to Dan. Dan, do you have a comment or question for David?
Yes, Mr. Rockefeller, thank you for taking the call. My son has worked up in Inuvik in the Northwest Territories for many years, and his focus is on oil and natural gas drilling in the Arctic Ocean. One of the biggest concerns that he has studied and written on is the dangers of this type of mineral exploration with the ice conditions that are created or happen during the winter in comparison to what recently happened in the Gulf of Mexico. It was difficult enough to shut that accident down. Do you have any thoughts on what else might need to be done in terms of precautionary studies in terms of drilling or looking for natural gas and oil under the ice in the Arctic?
Thanks, Dan.
Really, really important questions, Dan. And, the fact that your son is doing what he's doing is another answer to a previous caller. What can we do? We can get our children engaged because they're hopefully going to be on the face of this globe longer than their parents are, and hopefully will contribute to the solving of these problems. I am very, very concerned about Arctic oil and gas extraction, and for the reasons that you suggest. The Arctic does not have the kind of response team availability. We don't have Coast Guard up there. You're talking about Canada. The same would be true in Alaska. So if there were a spill, it would probably take a week before we had anything like a response team to try to contain it. And containment is absolutely vital when there is a spill. So I know that the Obama administration has tentatively given some permits to do studies of Arctic supplies, but I am very concerned that we not embark on drilling until we have the infrastructure, frankly, to manage the likely spills. I mean, spills do happen. We know that. You cannot guarantee they won't.
And there's a big difference of spill up in Arctic climate as opposed to what we saw in the Gulf of Mexico, where the warm waters may help dissipate some of the oil. That's not going to happen up in the Arctic, is it?
Well, it's not. And you know, one other thing that's counterintuitive. You sort of think of the Arctic as a refrigerator, and the oceans are frozen and nothing could live there. The fact is, Arctic waters are extremely rich in fish and the lower part of the food web, the web of life in the ocean. They're vital, in fact, to the entire living ocean. And my principal concern here, actually, is whether we can feed the 7 billion people we now have on the globe, going up to probably 9 or 10 this century.
Dan, thank you again for your call. We're going to take another short break. When we return, more of your comments and questions for David Rockefeller Jr. Please stay with us.
I'm Lisa Mullins. Next time on The Changing World, the rise of Christianity in China.
We're living in a country where we're seeing the biggest revival in Christianity in world history.
China has an estimated 70 million Christians. It'll soon become the largest Christian nation on earth. The relationship between China's Communist Party and religion. Next time on The Changing World from the BBC and PRI.
Join us for that program coming up this afternoon at 1 o'clock.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, how our relationships with our siblings fundamentally shape the people we become. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
Join us for On Point tonight at midnight.
Welcome back. I'm Jonathan Smith, and you're listening to the Maine Public Broadcasting Network. Today on the program, philanthropist and sailor David Rockefeller Jr. is with us from our Bangor studios to talk about his work on behalf of our oceans. Share your thoughts. Call 1-800-399-3566. Email us at talk@mpbn.net or post a comment or question to our Facebook page. And we're going to go to Steve now. Steve, are you there?
Yes, thank you for having me on.
Thank you. You have a question or comment that I think really goes to the crux of the book and what we're talking about today. Go ahead.
I do believe in climate change, but what I've read from scientists is that even if every human on Earth stopped using fossil-based fuels, we would not see an appreciable change in the climate for 1,000 years. What can we do that will affect the climate today?
So, David, is it impossible to stop climate change, global warming?
Well, Steve has read something that I have not. I hope that it's not correct, that it would take 1,000 years before we could have an impact. I do think there are some things that we ought to do and need to do in regard to protecting the oceans that don't have a relationship to the warming trend. And meanwhile, you know, I'm driving a Prius. I don't own a car in New York where I live, and I'm trying to do my piece to reduce the emissions of CO2. It is a big problem. It's a long-term problem. And as Steve says, if we, you know, turned everything off today, it wouldn't stop tomorrow. I hope it's not 1,000 years before it turns in the other direction.
Steve,
but there are just so many things we can do.
Thank you for your call. Let's go to Jane now. Jane, do you have a comment or question?
Yes, good morning. I'm finding it refreshingly delightful that Mr. Rockefeller is so informed. My question is this. Is it possible to get the large financial concerns that develop the oil and the gas industry to become extremely involved in creating jobs for the conversion of our energy needs to solar power and other devolutionary forms of consumption? I think that would be proactive, and I think that it's very possible to have a great impact on the planet, because if we create the technology and the wherewithal to devolve ourselves from this oil and gas addiction and reduce our carbon footprint, I'm pretty sure that the planet would respond amazingly well, faster than we think.
Jane, thank you for your call. David, any comment?
Well, renewable energy has absolutely got to be a large piece of the solution here. And luckily, a lot of dollars are being put toward it. There are some oil companies which are reluctant to move rapidly in that direction, and frankly, it's because they've been so successful with high oil prices at doing what they've always done. And some members of my family are actually working on proxy fights with those companies to try to move them in the direction, Jane, that you suggest. But it's absolutely vital that we move in this way. And China, And we're sometimes very critical in the U.S. of China and their fast build-out and their rising middle class, enormous demands on energy, hundreds of coal plants being built. But I think actually they're as alert to this problem as we are. And if only our country and China could get together and co-determine to reduce the amount of carbon that we put in the atmosphere and move more quickly to renewable energy, I think that would be the best New Year's gift we could give the world.
All right, David, let's get back to the journey of the Ocean Watch. And now you were aboard for its passage around Cape Horn. Tell us what that was like. I understand it's in, that's been called sort of the Mount Everest of offshore sailing.
Well, it is, and we found out why. There were eight men, as I said earlier, on Ocean Watch when we started out to go around the Horn. And by the way, Cape Horn is actually an island or even a set of islands called the Las Islas de Hornos. And they are very dreary and dark and in a way spectacular. We needed to wait for a weather window and stayed in port at first in Puerto Williams, the farthest south town in the world. That's in Chile, on Patagonia. And we suddenly got the signal that there was a good weather window, meaning that the winds were not blowing on our nose at 60 knots for the 24 hours it might take us to get around. We went out. The winds were strong. They were 40 knots. And we hunkered down in a harbor about 10 miles away from Cape Horn, waiting for the higher wind to abate. We heard that the night that we were in harbor, and it was blowing 60 there, it was blowing over 100 at Cape Horn. So we were really glad not to be out there, since that was an adverse wind. The day we got there, you know, miracle of miracles, the sun didn't come out, but the wind blew modestly from behind, and we set a spinnaker, you know, a full-bellied sail that actually had the map of the two American continents in blue on it. There's a photograph in the book, One Island, One Ocean, of this. And we sailed around in relative calm and comfort. Just as a joke, I put on shorts and got photographed going around Cape Horn in shorts.
That's David Rockefeller Jr. talking about the book One Island, One Ocean. Join our conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. Send us an email, talk@mpbn.net, or leave a comment or question on our Facebook page. And let's go to Ruth now. Ruth, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Hi, Ruth. Did you have a comment or question for David?
Well, it's kind of a comment. I've been listening to a lot of people say that global warming is no such thing. But I had a grandmother who kept a diary every day. She wrote in it the weather and what was going on. And in one of the most notable examples that I have for global warming is she talked several times in her diary in the wintertime that in Blue Hill Bay they would have a fair on the bay where they would have a Ferris wheel and horse races. And she also talks about taking teams of horses from Blue Hill across the pack ice onto Long Island. I don't know if you know anything about Blue Hill, but it, you'd never want to think about doing anything like that now.
Ruth, yeah, thank you.
That's great, Ruth. And good to remember it wasn't so long ago. People we know have that image in their lifetimes. I know Blue Hill Bay very well, and I was saying to my family as we drove over that Somme Sound, the only fjord on the east coast of the Americas, used to be drivable by cars. Cars, I don't remember doing that, but I guess in the first half of the 20th century they did, and that wasn't a silly thing to do. These days you got to be a little careful even taking your ice shack out there to go ice fishing. You're lucky if the ponds freeze up well enough.
Let's go now to Barry. Barry, are you there?
Yes, I am. How are you doing?
Good. How are you? Thank you for calling. Do you have a comment or question for David?
Yes, I do. I was lived down in Searsport, and in, I don't know if you're familiar with Back Point. They have a chemical plant in a gasoline tank storage area down there, and they just bought an LNG company bought a 25 acres and clear cut it, and they're planning on putting a 167 foot tall LNG tank. Kind of railroaded through. They had a vote on it for the town, but they didn't let us know that LNG was going to go in there. And once it did, the town can't vote on it, and people in the area can't vote on it. And I'm a little concerned that if a terrorist act happened there, that it would probably devastate the whole Penobscot Bay there, and certainly would probably take out Searsport and how things like this can kind of happen where the public don't even have any input on it. I'm just kind of curious what your thoughts on that issue was.
Thanks for your call, Barry. David, any thoughts, comments on that?
Well, I think an activist public has got to be a part of solving all of these problems, and it's so great to hear, Barry, that you're part of that activist public. I don't know about the particular situation. I used to have a little condo on Boston Harbor, and when LNG tankers come into Boston Harbor, it's like a marine landing in there. They got helicopters and police cars on the dock right next to us, and police boats out there, and they do worry, as you suggest, about terrorist attacks. All of this, of course, is a balancing of our demand for energy and the efficiency of LNG as a form of it, and keeping us safe, whether it's from the possibility of terrorist attacks or from mercury poisoning or whatever it is, on the negative side of the ledger. And so I just urge everybody to get involved, and it sounds to me as though maybe the town could be taken to task for not giving full information.
Let's go to Peter now, where we've got under 2 minutes to go. Peter, do you have a quick comment or question for David?
Thanks for taking my call. This is Peter Alexander. I'm the lead organizer of the Gulf of Maine Restoration Initiative, and I'm wondering, Mr. Rockefeller, if you are familiar with the America's Great Waters Coalition and the regional moves to restore habitat, fish and wildlife habitat. I'll just mention the website. It's northeastgreatwaters.org, and I'd love to invite you to a conference we're having on June 12th at the Wells Reserve.
Peter, thank you for your call. David, real quickly, we've got about 30 seconds.
Great. Yes. You know, recovery is a local matter, and it's so important that local citizens become involved in, first of all, learning about issues that have to do with our waterways and our oceans, and then become involved in organizations, I'm sure, such as yours. So thanks so much for that public notice there.
David, I'm sorry to interrupt, but I want to thank you for joining us today. David Rockefeller Jr. is a philanthropist and avid sailor. He served on the Pew Oceans Commission and led the formation of Sailors for the Sea. He is director and former chairman of Rockefeller Financial. We've been discussing the book, One Island, One Ocean. Today's program was produced by Keith Shortall. John Kimmel ran the board. We had help from Rich Tozier and the MPBN web team. You can listen to this conversation and others by visiting mpbn.net. Click on the radio tab, then click Call-In Program. I'm Jonathan Smith. This is the Maine Public Broadcasting Network.